Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. And this week we're coming to you from Darling Harbour in Sydney, where Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has begun to welcome leaders from the 10 ASEAN member nations: Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia, Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, Brunei and Singapore.
We will work to advance our cooperation in these fields, just as we work to boost trade and investment and all of the other ties that bring Australia and Vietnam closer together all the time.
In a moment, I'll speak with the former Indonesian Foreign Minister, Marty Netalegawa, about the future of an association he says needs to be more ambitious and united.
The reality is that we are witnessing still, notwithstanding the many decades of efforts, a fundamental deficit in terms of trust between our regional countries.
And I'll sit down for a flat white with a man who loves Canberra even more than I do, the federal member for Fenner and shadow assistant treasurer, Dr. Andrew Lee.
You've got a place where you don't have to burn a litre of petrol to buy a litre of milk.
But first, here's political reporter Miles Morgan with a look back at the week that was in Canberra.
Thanks, Brett. The political year may have been derailed early on by some intensely personal scandals, but the last week saw federal politics firmly back in the realm of policy and analysis. In the last episode, I spoke about Malcolm Turnbull warning against trade tariffs being imposed on Australia by the United States. Well, it seems whatever the Prime Minister had been saying struck a chord. US President Donald Trump exempted Australia from his planned tariffs on steel and aluminium imports.
We have a very close relationship with Australia. We have a trade surplus with Australia. Great country, long-term partner. We'll be doing something with them.
And he did, but not without some characteristic confusion and last-minute negotiations. See, President Trump said that before the official tariff announcement. Then the official announcement made no mention regarding tariff exemptions for Australia. But within hours, Donald Trump announced Australia wouldn't face the trade barriers. How else but by Twitter? Malcolm Turnbull said he also spoke personally to the president.
He acknowledged these important points. Firstly, Australia is a strong ally of the United States. It has no better ally than Australia. 100 years of mateship is recognised. Secondly, whatever complaints the United States may have about other trading relationships, it has no complaints with respect to Australia.
The government says there was no trade-off for this trade deal. Mr. Turnbull denies Australia is expected to support future US military exercises in the troubled South China Sea, for example. In domestic politics, the focus turned back to taxes and your hip pocket. It's something we revisit every few months as the major parties slowly reveal their tax policies. This time, Labor's making an election promise. If it wins government, it's going to abolish the system of cash refunds through franking credits.
The current tax system has advantages in it which are weighted to the very wealthy and to large corporations. What we want to do is put the weight back in the economy and government to looking after middle and working class Australians.
That's Bill Shorten there, and if you don't know what franking credits are, then this probably doesn't affect you. Essentially, when you hold shares in a company, you can receive a dividend. Along with that dividend, you could get what's called a franked credit. The scheme's designed so that you don't have to pay tax on that dividend because the business already has. But if you don't pay any tax for the year, you can claim a cash refund with those franking credits. It's essentially a tax bonus, and opposition leader Bill Shorten predicts that policy would affect more than 200,000 people, but mostly part pensioners.
Times have changed. And if you've got to make choices, I make no apology for choosing to make sure that we spend more on childcare in this country than we do on giving tax refunds to people who've paid no income tax.
Treasurer Scott Morrison delights in criticising Labor policy, and it's obvious he doesn't like this one.
Bill Shorten is reaching his hand into their pocket and just ripping out the cash because he cannot control his spending. Normal people own shares, Bill. Normal people. Ordinary people. People who have worked hard. Pensioners. People on low incomes.
Brett, it's called class warfare, and it looks like we'll be hearing a lot more about it until the next election.
50 years after the Association of Southeast Asian Nations was founded, the first of 10 ASEAN leaders have arrived here in Sydney for a special summit. They've been invited to Australia by the Prime Minister to talk about trade and counter-terrorism. Earlier this week, I sat down with Dr. Marty Netalegawa, the former Indonesian Foreign Minister. He says that ASEAN is extremely good at convening conferences, but questions what the association is offering in terms of ideas for the future.
How significant is this special summit to the ASEAN-Australia relationship?
The use of the word significant is very apt and appropriate because our region, as you know very well, is undergoing through very difficult times, plenty of uncertainties about. And having the leaders of ASEAN and Australia here in Sydney, not only to reaffirm the bilateral, so to speak, relationship between the two sides, but to express their views on many developments in our region.
And what is it that Australia and ASEAN are trying to achieve from this meeting?
It's the things that are not already expressed in the formal documents that I think observers should be looking for. In other words, this is essentially it's a leaders level meeting, so the leaders will no doubt exercise leadership in terms of offering their thoughts and visions for our region and for the future as well. I mean, the developments in the geopolitical domain, we are now having the prospect of the dialogue between the United States and DPRK, the North Koreans, is coming to take place soon. So ASEAN and Australia must be part of the solution to that type of undertaking. In other words, insofar as the regular bilateral relations is concerned, I think there is sufficient material and outlook there to be pursuing. But it's the issues that only leaders can discuss. In other words, the issues that are of the most strategic type in terms of its ASEAN's and Australia's future ahead.
You've talked about challenges and uncertainty. You've mentioned one of the big ones, North Korea. What are some of the others? The growing rhetoric between Russia and the United States must be a pretty big challenge for the association.
Absolutely. You have referred to some of them, some of the problems and challenges that we are facing. But I would think that the ASEAN and Australian leaders will want to look beyond the headlines, beyond the developments that is now obviously taking place, Korean Peninsula, and the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and the like. But looking at the more fundamental dynamics, appreciation of what is actually happening in our part of the world. Do we need to address, for example, the issue of trust deficit, whether it be North Korea, in Korean Peninsula, and other bilaterals in our region? The reality is that we are witnessing still, notwithstanding the many decades of efforts, a fundamental deficit in terms of trust between our regional countries. How do we manage change? Does the rise of China, which is incessant and inevitable, should it be seen as a problem to be contained, a challenge to be managed, or is it something that is taken as a given and therefore be facilitated in ensuring a more conducive outcome in terms of our joint common security and common prosperity? In other words, I think the leaders should try to look beyond the obvious headlines, but to try to decipher the dynamics behind this. What are we seeing? Are we are witnessing, for example, the rise of transactional politics in terms of geo-economic developments, the potential for trade wars proliferating as a result of national policies by some countries. These are the type of strategic, political and economic issues that I think our leaders, ASEAN and Australia, must get express themselves on cohesively beyond the most obvious. I didn't even mention the problem of transnational nature. The issue of terrorism, the issue of the rise of intolerance, and the issue of the threats from natural disasters. These are issues that leaders must discuss and have a common view expressed on as well.
As a very experienced diplomat, how worried are you about the rise of nationalism? It's not just happening in China and Russia, the United States and Europe, but it's also happening here in our own region right now. How dangerous is this rise in nationalism to ASEAN's ambitions?
Well, I think there's nothing inimical, nothing conflicting between nationalism and diplomacy and foreign policy. A sense of pride in one's nation, patriotism, nationalism has been is a perennial sentiment and spirit in all our countries. But in the past, we have managed to manage such dynamics in a way that is complementary to efforts at diplomacy, efforts at promotion of cooperative relationship and partnership. The problem begin when one begin to think and assume as if they are a zero sum, that you can either be nationalistic, means you are angry with the world, essentially, as if you are burning bridges left and right and putting first and foremost your own national interests and not recognizing and empathizing the other side. I think in the past we have managed to strike a good equilibrium between those type of sentiments, and therefore dispelling the notion as if they are two opposite poles, that they are actually complementary. ASEAN has been such a vehicle in the past in promoting a win-win, common prosperity, common security type of approach. But you are quite correct. At the moment, there is a school of thought. It has become quite popular to suggest as if to be seen to be patriotic, to be seen to be looking after one's nation, you have to be somehow anti-global, anti-regional, and the like. And this is where I think a great deal of a more deliberative, a bit more nuanced and calibrated discussion must take place. Our world is a world where there are problems that defy national solutions. You know, whether you speak of economies, the security issues, natural disasters, transnational issues, no one country can solve these problems on their own, and hence we must have cooperative partnership. And in promoting such an outlook, you can't have an a la carte approach where, you know, you only cooperate when it suits you, but you won't extend the same courtesy when you are not involved or you are not interested in the issue. So I think this is a great, a huge homework for diplomats nowadays to try to ensure that actually nationalism, patriotism, and diplomacy and foreign policy has traditionally go hand in hand. They are not mutually exclusive. They can be working in synergy with one another.
Is it right for the Prime Minister to raise Australia's concerns about human rights with some of these leaders during this summit? And how delicate is this balancing act for Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, you use the term balancing act. It is quite apt and quite appropriate to describe it in this way. The world we live in is the world of sovereign nation states, where we respect one another's the principle of non-interference is respected and is cardinal in a way in countries' relationship. But at the same time, at least in the past, that has not stopped and prevented countries to convey a sense of concerns and attention in an appropriate way, calibrated way, when there are developments that are affecting the wider region and actually causing concern genuinely to issue of human rights and governance. And I think ASEAN now should have sufficient confidence and should have sufficient wherewithal to be openly engaged in such conversation. I think the days of us, ASEAN, simply saying no, shutting the whole thing down as if don't even raise such issue, I think is long past us, because human rights, democracy, good governance is now part and parcel of ASEAN's conversation. Through the ASEAN political security community. So it will be a rather strange situation when we don't even want to engage. To my ASEAN colleagues and friends, I would be counseling and suggesting that we should have the confidence to engage in such conversation so that any misunderstanding, misperception can be addressed. But to our Australian friend, of course, such concern must be conveyed in an appropriate way, in a way that is problem solving rather than problem creating.
Eight weeks out from the federal budget, and Labor has begun to unveil parts of its tax plan. I sat down with the Shadow Assistant Treasurer, Dr. Andrew Lee, in Braddon.
You weren't an MP when I was last living in Canberra, and your electorate has changed a lot. This is where I used to come and buy bits of spare car and camping equipment, and now it's where I come for my smashed avocado and flat white coffees. You're very proud of Canberra.
Enormously proud. And as you say, the transformation in Braddon is indicated, Brett, with the fact that one of the great burger joints here is called Grease Monkey. But this is a fabulous electorate to represent. You've got a place where you don't have to burn a litre of petrol to buy a litre of milk.
And the electorate in which we're chatting today has also changed.
Well, indeed. Jim Fraser was a great local member, somebody who's still well remembered for his time as member for the ACT and surrounding areas. But after Malcolm Fraser passed away, as is normal, the Australian Electoral Commission wanted to create a Malcolm Fraser electorate in Victoria, so they abolished the Jim Fraser electorate in the ACT and replaced it with an electorate named after Frank Finner, the great Australian scientist who announced the eradication of smallpox to the World Health Organization, and also who pioneered the use of myxomatosis and famously injected himself with enough myxomatosis virus to kill 1,000 rabbits in order to prove to the Australian public that the myxomatosis wouldn't make the jump from rabbits to humans.
And what do you see as the big issues that are affecting Australians heading into what will likely be an election in the next year?
I think growth with equity is a huge challenge for Australia. We've got an economy at the moment that is basically stalled, where living standards haven't been rising at the pace they should be. We've got a disconnect increasingly between productivity and wages, where the benefits of productivity aren't flowing through to workers, at least not to workers in the middle of the distribution. Those in the top 1% are enjoying significant earnings gains. But low and middle income Australians have had a tough few years. And so with rising inequality and growth slower than it should be, I think it's really important that we're investing in those engines of prosperity. Great infrastructure, terrific schools, making sure we've got a national broadband network that actually brings the glass cables all the way to the home rather than having the last section done in 19th century copper. Those sort of investments are vital, and Labor intends to pay for them by making sure we've got a fairer taxation system in which we close down tax loopholes for millionaires and multinationals.
One of the issues that Labor's had in recent years is people trusting Labor with the economy. And when you talk to Liberal MPs and coalition government ministers, they see the economy as their really strong plank, that and border security. How hard is it for you and the rest of the Labor shadow front bench to sell your economic credentials?
You just look at the numbers. Analysis recently done by Stephen Koukoulas said, let's look at the extent to which Australia outperforms the United States when Labor governments are in office and when coalition governments are in office, and found that on average that gap is bigger when Labor governments are in office. The most recent example is the Labor stimulus package, which ensured that Australia didn't go into recession in the global financial crisis, saving tens of thousands of businesses and hundreds of thousands of jobs. Joe Stiglitz described that as one of the best stimulus packages anywhere in the world. And so the mantle of strong economic managers, I think, sits firmly with us. We should never rest on our laurels, and that's why this opposition has brought out more economic policy than any other opposition in a generation, because we want to be really honest with the Australian people about what we do if we're fortunate enough to win office.
This week, the Chief Minister here in the ACT has made some comments about the Fourth Estate, his dislike for the media. What's your take on that, and how do you think that flies in Canberra?
Well, I think Andrew is talking about the importance of engaging in different ways with the public, and that's certainly something that I find in my own role. This is, I think, my fifth interview with somebody who is a formal working journalist today. But I'm aware that none of those five interviews will get seen by a majority of the people in the electorate. So we're always looking at different ways to engage. We held a local community park cleanup on Saturday, and I had a range of political conversations around the barbecue around that. I'm active on Facebook, on Twitter. I send out a monthly email update saying the things I'm up to. I'll do street corner meetings. And I think Andrew's comment there is just reflecting that in an increasingly fragmented media age, the challenge on politicians to step up and engage with the community to keep up the quality and the quantity of the democratic conversation is harder than ever.
Andy, you are very active, as you say. You even have your own podcast. Any tips for us? As amateurs, as the new kids on the podcast block.
Look, I think you're doing a fabulous job. I've just really enjoyed the Good Life podcast because it takes me out of the often quite adversarial world of politics and policy. So the Good Life podcast is focused on living a happy, healthy and ethical life. I get on people who not for their intelligence, but for their wisdom. So I had a conversation yesterday with palliative care expert Liz Forbat. I spoke to Benjamin Law last week about everything from sex to taboos to making wontons. I've spoken to Peter Singer about effective altruism, to Michael Kirby about the ability to engage with those who are different from you. My colleague Linda Burney had a fabulous podcast conversation with me in which she talked about what it is to be raised by step-parents who were born in the 19th century. So I find that it makes me a better and wiser parliamentarian, and perhaps ideally even a little more grateful and a little more generous.
And just finally, as the only international news bulletin in Australia, we're each night looking at what's happening around the world. What's something that's happened in the world in the last, say, 2 weeks that you're excited about, that you think is an uplifting story, and what's something that you kind of lay awake at night thinking about that worries you about the state of the world at the moment?
I think the changes that we've seen in the United States tax law as they relate to accelerated depreciation are actually really interesting. There's been a lot of contestation over Donald Trump's big tax package, but the one bit that's received bipartisan support, including from progressives like Jason Furman, who was Barack Obama's former head of the Council of Economic Advisors, is accelerated depreciation, because that's rewarding brand new investment rather than rewarding companies for decisions they made last year. It's not a policy that hopes for investment, it's a policy that guarantees investment. So I like that. And as it happens, Federal Labor has announced today that we'd do something quite similar to that one little slice of the Trump tax policy if we were to win election. I'm depressed at the same time, though, looking at the United States, and I listen regularly to the NPR One app in the morning, with their inability to get on top of gun violence. Something in the order of 90 Americans a day dying to guns, most of them suicides. And unlike Australia, there's still too many guns in bedside tables, in the car glove boxes, tucked into teenagers' waistbands going out on a Saturday night. And I try and encourage my American friends, and whenever I get a chance to do American media on this, to look at the example of the Australian gun buyback, which Christine Neal and I showed not only reduced gun homicides, but also gun suicides, while also maintaining a healthy sporting shooting culture. My morning run takes me past both the rifle range and the pistol range in my electorate. There's plenty of Canberrans who participate in those sports, but we don't see the gun deaths that America sees, and it saddens me that America hasn't gotten on top of gun violence.
Andrew Lee, thank you very much. Probably the only man I've met who dreams at night about tax reform.
And during the day sometimes. Thank you, Brett.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.